Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian, Insight Podcast number 167, recording this on Friday the 20th May, 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield for the site, and with me, the chief honcho of All About Symbian, Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody. It's good to be here.
And also our Eurovision correspondent up in Scotland.
It's Ewan Spence, and no Eurovision today. Today, I just want to point out that 167 is the third Einsteinian prime number that has no imaginary part.
The things you learn on this podcast. And also we have our Hull correspondent.
Hello, everybody. No clever lines from me today. I'm just glad to be here.
That's David Gilson, of course. So plenty to get through this week. It may have been a slightly slow news week, but plenty to review, certainly. The applications do seem to be coming quick and fast. We have had some statistics in. Gartner have weighed in on quarter one 2011. We did have figures from IDC earlier this month, but Gartner have produced a slightly more operating system-centric version of the figures, and also given us a few more tasty morsels, if you will. I've got a few points to make, just a few headline figures, first of all. Quarter 1, 2011, then. Android OS smartphones sold 36 million. Symbian, 27 million. iOS, 16 million. Research in Motion, i.e. BlackBerry, 13 million. Now, I've got a few points to make before I open this to the wider team. First of all, smartphones now accounted for 23% of overall sales. That's almost doubled since last year. So what they're saying is that last year, something like 14% of all phones sold were smartphones. This year, it's up to almost 24%. Surely at some point, we're going to get to the point where the amount of smartphones compared to the amount of phones will get to nearer 50%. And at that point, we will genuinely stop calling them smartphones. They will simply become phones.
Yes, that's right, Steve. It's amazing, really, how far smartphones have come. Although I will say in all of this that it is only, you know, a quarter of the market, so there's plenty of room left to grow. The interesting debate becomes, you know, will smartphones take over the rest of the market, or how far will they go? And I think the problem here we then get is definition of what's a smartphone. And we already see this happening, you know, people saying it's not a smartphone, it is a smartphone. And yes, undoubtedly, we're going to see this move towards, if you like, the open platforms. But I think there becomes a point at which, you know, you're going to have to subdivide that or whatever. And I'm not sure that the feature phone, as we think of it today, will necessarily go away. A good example of this is looking at something like Series 40, which I think is actually going to be with us for quite some time to come. You know, some people have said there won't be anything but smartphones in, you know, 3 or 4 years. It depends on the report you read. But I think the point is feature phones will get smarter and add more features in, you know, to become more like smartphones. And indeed, if you look at something like the first smartphone, or, you know, the Nokia 7650, for example, it's considerably less advanced than, you know, the best feature phones that we have on the market. If you look at maybe some of Nokia's touch and type devices with all the service functionality they have in terms of things like Maps and Ovi Store, and, you know, their general ability capturing photos, multimedia playback, you know, they're significantly in advance of that.
Sure.
And, you know, we've had this kind of trend of, you know, smartphones taking over everything. And I think actually that might be a bit of a misnomer in one sense. So I think it's, you know, we have to be careful when we say one in every whatever phone sold is a smartphone now, because I think we get to the point where, you know, there's such a big difference between the top end smartphone and the low end smartphone, and it overlaps with what's feature phone. So, I mean, from a personal point of view, I actually expect Series 40 to continue to, you know, sell quite well. Nokia actually said they're going to put more money into it, but it will become more and more smartphone-like. And, you know, there's been suggestions that Qt might be ported onto Series 40. And at that point, if you've got Qt running on Series 40, does that then become a smartphone platform, or is it still a feature phone platform? And I think you can see similar things going on elsewhere. But yes, in general, I would agree with the idea that, you know, all phones will become smart in the sense they'll be able to add third-party program through app stores and similarly with services, and will be more sophisticated out of the box. But of course, there's always going to be a big demand for cheap, you know, the low-cost devices, which are the, you know, basic communication tools. And you know, they will get smarter over time, but it'll happen very slowly. You know, there are a lot of people just using mobiles for calls and texts, and I think that will remain true even if their capabilities may be increased. You know, the £10 phones that you see as pairs, you go, they're going to be with us for a long, long time.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say that just on that subject, that Nokia's Series 40 phone, obviously Nokia investing in, quote, the next billion, they will have to sort out the lack of multitasking. And I know that doesn't matter for just going between music and messaging and so forth, but I've been trying the social networking tools on the touch and type phones, and it's to take 15 seconds to get back into your Facebook messages after you've just answered a phone call or just checked the calendar is ridiculous. And where have we seen this in other even smartphone operating systems, Windows Phone 7, the lack of multitasking for anything more than the basics really is crippling.
Yeah, I think we should point out here it's the perception of multitasking. I mean, Series 40 is quite capable of multitasking, as most people will know, but it's actually the way it's delivered to the end user. And of course, the trouble is that when you're talking about these cheaper devices, you've got less resources available in terms of processor, RAM, memory, and so keeping things running in the background or the perception of that becomes more difficult to achieve because you've got less to do it with. But I do agree these kind of feature phones need to start doing more multitasking in the way we think of it on a smartphone. I mean, there are plenty of examples of feature phones out there that do multitask. Series 40 is one of them, and in Sony Ericsson, their Java phones, you know, have that multitasking capability. Well, a lot of Java phones actually do it now compared to the past where, you know, you just have one Java application running at a time. So, you know, again, it's an interesting one. Definition becomes more important, and it's how it's perceived to be the end user. It's the idea that you need to do multiple things at the same time and be able to switch instantly between them, and how you achieve that from a technical point of view can be more complex.
Yeah, there are 3 points I wanted to make from these Gartner figures before we move on. The first one is that despite the well-documented imminent, quote, retirement of Symbian, it should be noted that they sold almost as many units in quarter one 2011 as Apple iPhones and BlackBerry devices combined, which is, I know they're behind Android now, but from many, many manufacturers. But the numbers are still pretty healthy, and the February the 10th, 11th announcements, that was just before the halfway point in the quarter. So even after that, there were still some pretty healthy sales, showing again that most people actually buying Symbian smartphones around the world probably have no idea whatsoever of Nokia's impending strategy changes. Certainly, I think I may have related on one of these podcasts, I was talking to a phone shop owner about 3 weeks after February the 11th, and I mentioned, oh yeah, what do you think of Nokia switching to using Windows Phone next year? And she hadn't heard it. She hadn't the faintest idea that this happened, and she owned a phone shop. So I think the long tail, the fall from grace from the top of the table down to the bottom will take a lot longer in terms of sales figures for Symbian than many journalists expect. I think we'll still be looking at Symbian being number two in quarter two 2011 and maybe even quarter three, which I think will surprise many people. Two other just quick points. On the subject of the Windows Phone 7 platform, we finally got some hard numbers. Gartner actually produced 1.6 million Windows Phone 7 devices sold in quarter one 2011, much, much less than many people had thought. Now, I don't think this necessarily pronounces a death knell on Windows Phone and as an iOS. It's certainly very promising in terms of look and feel. Maybe we'll come back to that later in this podcast because David's been playing with the HD7 recently. But I do think we're certainly waiting for Nokia to come on board to give it a real kick up the bottom, because until then, Windows Phone 7 is just languishing at the bottom of everybody's tables. One final point on the Gartner figures. This is a quote by Ms. Koza, of Gartner, who says the shift towards an ecosystem focus, application and services, is the critical success factor for device manufacturers. And this is a fascinating insight here. She says, every time a user downloads a native app to their smartphone or puts their data into a platform's cloud service, every time they're committing to a particular ecosystem and reducing the chances of switching to a new platform. I think that's a fascinating insight. Every time someone actually invests anything in terms of their data, even putting their data into a platform or signs up for an email address with a particular service, then they're committing to that ecosystem, and it reduces the chances they're going to switch ecosystem later on. Ewan, you had a comment there?
Yeah, it's twofold on that one. It's let's take the latter one first. The idea that you have ecosystem lock-in has been with us a long time, and it's one of the reasons why Ovi was going to be one of Nokia's key plank strategies. At least that's what they thought a couple of years ago. We talked about that extensively last week. Nokia now really don't have that. When they pair up with Windows, as as you're theorizing there, the idea is that people will swing back to buy Nokia and they'll just happen to have Windows Phone on it, and phone shops and customers will just go, it's a rock solid Nokia with a great phone and it's got one of these slidey operating systems like in a Japanese anime thing. But that buy-in will then actually, well, it remains to be seen, but the buy-in will be mostly into Facebook and Microsoft Windows Live, and potentially also the Xbox system. So one of the things that Nokia may be giving up is that consumer lock-in that they've never actually quite managed to crack a hold of. And the big danger, of course, as everybody is that Nokia becomes a very big, very efficient box pusher for Windows Phone. And you know, that would be quite nice for the shareholders, but it does mean that they would be ceding that sort of point in the market where they can control the decision. So, you know, it is a risky strategy, as we've said all along, but they don't have that lock-in themselves, so they need to bring in an ecosystem. And let's be honest, Windows Live, Xbox Live, and the very tight integration that Windows Phone has with Facebook, which isn't present on any of the other major platforms, gives them an access to a big group of people to lock in. So, you know, it remains to be played out here. But that, in a nutshell, is going to be one of Nokia's problems going forward for the next 6 to 9 months. People aren't going to be investing in a system that can be taken forward over 2 or 3 years until they come up with those big handsets for Microsoft.
Yeah. David?
Yeah, ecosystems is something I spend a lot of time looking at and thinking about. I mean, the idealist in me absolutely detests any sort of lock-in. Although in practice, I think there's two different types of ecosystem that we need to look at. I mean, on one hand, there's the services like email and chat, etc. In most cases, there isn't any sort of lock-in. Any platform will support any email service. I mean, for example, I've got my Gmail running on my Nokia, on my Symbian Windows Phone and Android phone, so that's fine. But the real lock-in comes in when you look at applications. Not only do you have applications that will only run on one type of phone, but you're also putting money into that. So when you switch platforms, you're actually losing money because you can't use the applications that you paid for. I think it would be interesting over time when networks get faster and web browsers become more capable, whether the mobile web will really take over from apps. Because I think the biggest thing holding them back is network latency rather than the prowess of HTML5. I think that covers what I wanted to say there. So,
right.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I mean, with all of this, I mean, I do agree with the point that Gartner's making about each of interaction adding an extra layer of lock-in. But I would caution people from attaching too much importance to this. At this point in time, I think the main driving forces behind people buying a new phone are often brand of the phone itself, what it looks like, the style of the design, and of course the cost, and advanced thinking, if you like, about this isn't on the right platform, I've really invested in such and such a thing, I think is less paramount. I mean, I'm just cautioning people to put, you know, too much emphasis on this at this point in time. I think, you know, looking to the future, yes, it's going to increase, but as David was saying, there's all sorts of interesting things that are coming about portability between platforms, and actually I think that might become an important point. I think we're still at the point that actually supporting services that users like, so, you know, having properly integrated Facebook onto the phone or Twitter or whatever service it happens to be is going to be more important for users, you know. And yes, apps are potentially the biggest lock-in because of obviously incompatibilities between platforms. But the number of applications downloaded that are, you know, something that someone definitely wants to transfer to their next phone, for the majority of people, that's still a relatively small area. I do appreciate there are power users who the lock-in, I think, is all the greater. And clearly that shows, if you look into the future, it's going to go more that way. But I think it's still very early days in that respect. And I think we see that in that you do see a lot of power users switching from, you know, one platform to the other, from iPhone to Android or whatever it happens to be. And to an extent, I think it's actually going to be the core services on a phone, things like Maps, the email experiences, which, you know, somewhat ironically are actually more transferable, maybe they're sort of things that people get most familiar with and therefore want to keep. And that sort of whole UI experience rather than perhaps individual applications. But it's going to be a really interesting area to watch because obviously it is going to dictate, you know, It's things like how much does it cost a company to, you know, get the user in the first place, and can they then retain it? And we see that kind of figures with operator churn and all that sort of thing. I wonder if we might see statistics in the future that talk about that in sort of ecosystem terms, if we do end up with the three big ecosystems, you know, Apple, Android, and sort of Nokia, Microsoft. It will be interesting to see, you know, what happens in terms of the interaction there.
Just one interesting point to add to that is I actually saw in the news yesterday that TweetDeck have announced that they're going to produce a mobile web client. Because as people have been waiting for TweetDeck to arrive on Windows Phone 7, you can use it on Android and iOS, but it hasn't come on Windows Phone 7 yet, and as we know, it's not on Symbian, but they are going to be making a mobile web version, which in theory should be platform agnostic. So there's one little sign of things starting in that sense.
Yeah. Let's move on. We've got an item of news hot off the press. Qt seems to go from strength to strength in the last few weeks. It's been amazing, the flurry of news and releases. And today, as we record this, Qt Quick 3D is now available, so you can do various 3D rendering within. Was it within QML, Rafe? What's the significance of this, and how ready is it?
First of all, it is just a sort of a preview, so this isn't sort of a consumer-ready release, but it's one that's of interest to developers, so it is worth mentioning quickly. And yes, it's really done within QML, and it's being able to build in 3D content, specifically sort of OpenGL stuff, the models that you might do in something like Studio Max or Blender, and put them into your application. There are also a certain amount of sort of stock things you can do with QML itself. You know, it's adding shapes like cylinders and cubes, or doing some shading. It's possible to sort of do some animation stuff as well. And it's the ability to sort of do the control of these 3D scenes with QML states. So you can sort of write the logic, if you like, for some of the control in JavaScript and use it alongside, you know, Qt. Other graphic elements, you know, graphic scene and that kind of thing. And so it's really the integration of potentially 3D content into the Qt environment, and obviously that has some interesting possibilities for games and applications. In terms of when it will become available, we're probably going to see this supported in the next version of QML, and there's obviously going to be some integration into the Qt tools like Qt Creator, but in a sense, this is really about the integration of, say, of this 3D content and the OpenGL stuff into Qt in a way that then is quite easy to use, is approachable for new users. But you know, Qt have Nokia released a few demos of this that you can install onto an N900 or a Symbian 3 phone, and you know, showing this off quite nicely. Performance is very good. Yeah. So it, more at the point, I think people just need, this is an interesting thing that's on the way, and as you say, sort of speaks to the continuing evolving of Qt. So I would imagine actually we might see some applications using this kind of thing by the end of the year. Difficult to give an exact timeline, but certainly an interesting development.
Yeah. Let's move on to a few of the reviews we've done on the site, allaboutsymbian.com, over the last week or so. I remember when I used to work in aerospace, guys, we were working on the Airbus airliners. We had these magnetic outlines of the planes, and they would stick on a magnetic kind of desk stand, and you could have them artistically arranged. They're climbing towards the sky. And every time we felt the projects had taken a turn for the worse, we would just knock the magnetic outlines that they'd be pointing down towards the floor. In the case of Flight Control, which is a game title which has done fabulously well on iPhone and other platforms, the Symbian version done by... which developer was it, Ewan?
See, this is where it gets confusing and probably lazy problem. It's actually been, as far as I can tell, it's been published by Electronic Arts. We don't know who's actually done the coding, but Electronic Arts were given a sub-license from Namco, who'd bought the mobile license, not the smartphone license, the mobile license from the original developers, Firemint. Firemint coded the versions for Android and iOS and did a very good job of it.
So basically, if I read your review right, we would say that, to use my analogy, the aircraft and Flight Control are heading perilously straight towards the ground. Is that right?
Indeed, yes, because this isn't actually Flight Control. This is the Tupolev 154 version of Flight Control, which is really nice to look at. But the second you wanted to do anything, it will just visit the Paris Air Show very quickly, vertically. Right then. This is an absolute mess, and the reason is pretty simple. The base code of this version of the game by Electronic Arts can be written in Java to be as portable over as many dumb phones and feature phones as possible, to have the name Flight Control in the stores, to have it bought. It, essentially, this is cashing in on the name of Flight Control with a game that's almost but not quite like Flight Control. The problem is when you come to Symbian and upgrade that Java and you give it the touchscreen and you give it a little bit of sound and everything, it's still assuming that it's got really low processor stuff. It provides jerky graphics. It's not smooth. It doesn't have the accuracy that you need in the touchscreen to play the game. And when you look at something like the Need for Speed games, you know, which the graphics outpace the iOS devices and are certainly comparable to Android, you know that the Symbian platform can handle fast-moving graphics. 5 sprites of an aircraft should not slow down your gameplay. It does.
Yes, that's it's quite sad.
Simple. It's quite simple. If you like Flight Control, avoid. If you like Flight Control and you're a developer, if somebody would make a really good version of the game, you know, Harbor Master is a clone of Flight Control on iOS and plays just as nicely. There is a market for a well done, accurate, smooth line drawing genre game on Symbian like Flight Control. Unfortunately, Flight Control is not it.
Yes, it'd be fair to say that Mr. Ewan Spence is the reviewer for you, though. So if you're a developer, do please get in touch. Ewan would absolutely love a terrific Flight Control clone, as you can tell there. You jumped on the review as soon as I mentioned that it was available. It's just such a shame that it's a huge, huge disappointment. And people who say we don't criticise things enough on All About Symbian, let's say Ewan and I both absolutely love writing horrifically negative, scathing reviews where justified. They're actually more fun to write than the good reviews.
I just guess I picked the wrong week to start playing Symbian games again.
Oh, and there's the airplane reference there. we must move on. Other reviews. Cute Box has been released, yet another unofficial Symbian client for Dropbox. I guess by this stage we can assume that the official Dropbox company are not going to release a Symbian client, but there's no shortage of third-party alternatives. Rafe, do you want to go first on this one? How good is Cute Box?
It's a bit like London Busters. You say, you know, you want a Dropbox client, and then all of a sudden you get loads coming on at once. Cute Box is actually one of the commercial ones. They're charging, I think it's $1.50 or £1.50, so it's, you know, pretty cheap, and it's been very nicely implemented. The UI is very slick. It sort of follows the same principles really that Dropbox itself does, with simplicity and ease of use at the heart of it. It's been, you know, developed in Qt and QML, and so, you know, in terms of getting access to the core functions of Dropbox, which of course uploading and downloading files from your sort of Dropbox storage, it works very well. It's also got integration for the sort of sharing features in terms of stuff sitting in the public folder. And I was just impressed with the overall smoothness of the implementation. And obviously a lot of thought has gone into the design of the application. You know, you can do even the more complex stuff that some of the other clients sometimes miss out on, in terms of being able to select multiple files at the same time, create folders. And generally, it's a very pleasant to use application. So there are plenty of other Dropbox clients out there. A couple more have come out this week. I just give a shout out to DropML, which I think is probably one of the best of the completely free ones. But anyone who's looking to get this sort of functionality on their phone is now well served. I would say that probably I'd still overall recommend SugarSync if you're starting from scratch, but I think in most cases that people will already be using Dropbox or another service. But if you are starting from scratch, SugarSync have actually gone to the trouble of developing their own first-party Symbian client, and it's available for pretty much every Symbian phone, and you get a slightly more generous amount of free storage when you sign up, and there's a few more features on the desktop. So SugarSync's actually my preferred service, but I was very pleased to see Qtbox come along, because it's a very slickly done implementation of the Dropbox service on Symbian 3 devices.
Yeah, I installed Qtbox on C7 this morning just as research for this podcast, and I was really impressed with it actually. One thing that I thought was missing, which I would have liked to have seen, integration into the send menu, so that you can view a file, say go into a photo gallery and send, and then just have it sent straight up to Dropbox through via Qtbox. From there, it doesn't do that. You have to go into Qtbox to upload. DropML, I haven't tried that yet, although I am scheduled to review it next week, so we might be able to do a little comparison next week. Just a little shout out to Pixelpipe as well, because if you do want to be able to upload things to Dropbox from your send menu, that's exactly what Pixelpipe does, so I recommend people take a look at that as well, because it's free.
I should mention, of course, that Dropbox is famous for basically synchronizing an entire folder and sort of set of folders on one device to another device. So basically, it keeps everything in step. And, of course, this is exactly what you don't necessarily want to happen on a phone, because in my case, I've got something like 10 gigabytes of my Mac's hard disk all neatly synced up to Dropbox. And the last thing I want is 10 gigabytes worth of files, many of which are multimedia, syncing down to my phone. So this is really about ease of access and speed of access to those, to that synchronized set of folders from your phone to the service to grab the bits you need. So just don't think that you're having to sync your entire Dropbox library down to the phone every time, because that's not how it works. Another news item, there are 6 new Symbian phones. But don't get too excited. They're all over available just in Japan in NDT Docomo's summer 2011 lineup. Is there a star here, Rafe? Anything people should watch out for or at least be interested in?
Well, I think it's always interesting looking at the NTT Docomo devices, because they tend to be, you know, technically pretty advanced. I mean, I did say in the news story, a lot of people in Europe might regard these as kind of feature phones, as they don't have the ability to add sort of native third-party applications in the traditional sense of a smartphone. There are some sort of services for adding Java-style applications. But yes, you're right, there's 6 of them. There's 4 of them are flip phones and 2 of them are sort of tablet-esque phones, one of which I think is a slider. And these are made by Fujitsu and Sharp over in Japan. And generally they sell about 3 million Symbian phones in Japan a quarter. So, you know, actually making up a fairly significant chunk of, you know, the smartphone market. Just picking out a few features, almost all of these are water and dust proof. You know, they have digital TV receivers built in, they've all got GPS and all got significant cameras. One of them, the F09C, actually has a 16 megapixel camera, can capture full HD video. That's the full HD as opposed to 720p that we generally see in Europe. And, you know, touch screens, etc. Some of them are just non-touch screens. They're done by just driven by a keypad. But, you know, it always amazes me to see these come out. But I think there is one that has particularly caught people's eye, and that's the Fujitsu Lux F07C. You know, they don't seem to be any better at naming devices than Nokia sometimes seems to be. But this particular device is a horizontal slider with a full QWERTY keyboard. But its claim to fame, really, is that it dual boots both Windows 7 and Symbian. In terms of the way this actually works, it's really 2 devices in one, and they happen to share the keyboard and the screen. But I think in terms of the inside bit, there's effectively a mini tablet, if you like, running the Windows 7. And that's done off an Intel Atom processor. It's got a gigabyte of RAM, a 32 gigabyte SSD in there, Wi-Fi connectivity. And then there's also a MoApp, or Symbian MoApp, that's kind of the version of Symbian that is used in these Japanese phones, sitting inside it as well. But they're not really connected, although it's got some interesting power-saving features. If the Windows 7 portion of the phone is getting low on battery, it'll switch over to Symbian because it's got much better power management characteristics. but this is effectively a way of having a tablet in your phone. But as I say, they aren't really connected as much as you might imagine. It's in one sense 2 devices glued together. Yeah. I mean, there is a sort of a cradle for the device, which when you're using it in Windows 7 mode effectively means you can then use a keyboard and a big screen because it's got HDMI out and USB ports, which I think is a really interesting idea, combining these 2 devices into one. But it's obviously early days in this kind of thing. But, you know, it's interesting. Japan's often ahead of the trend. So I wonder whether this is something we might see more of in the future. And you sort of wonder, would it be possible to have a Windows phone device from Nokia that then maybe, you know, transition somehow into full version of Windows? I think that's perhaps a bit unlikely. But nonetheless, kind of an interesting as a technical curiosity at the very least.
Yeah. We're running a bit short of time, but several bits I wanted to fit in. We have some mini reviews. Right, each of you has got 30 seconds. News flow from David, Mullum from Rafe, and the impossible game from Ewan. So let's see how snappy we can make these. David.
Okay, Newsflow is a Qt Google Reader application from Tommy Laukkanen, who's a Qt developer who has released his work on Symbian and MAME 05 as well. Doesn't give any visual resemblance to Google Reader, but it has all of the basic features, although there are some features which don't work. And if you're interested in using this, I would say this is best for reading, but stick with a mobile site if you want to actually manage your posts and feeds.
Lovely. 29 seconds. You had a second to spare there. I'm impressed. Rafe, Malome.
Malome has been described as an Instagram clone for Symbian. I'll agree very much with that. It's a way of uploading your pictures, both to the Malome surface, but also Facebook and Twitter. And you can add filters, tweak them a little bit. So adding a bit more fun to that kind of photo and picture uploading. There's also a community element to it. You can follow people. So it's similar to any other photo sharing service in that respect. But it's been nicely implemented. It's a cute application, pretty slickly done. And if you're into sort of that kind of sharing your pictures onto Facebook and Twitter, this is a nice way to do it.
Even more impressive. Rafe comes in under time and under budget. Ewan.
So the Impossible Game is a Qt application. It also uses QML to power the menu. At first glance, it might look like one of those running games where you press the key and your little square bounces up over the obstacles. Of course, if you touch one of them, you're dead. In actual fact, because of the speed of the game, old people like me, you don't have enough reaction time to react to these obstacles. What you need to do is listen to the music in the background to get the rhythm and intonation. That, coupled with tiny clues in the game field, will allow you to jump over your obstacles a great way. It's not impossible, it's just hard.
Lovely, lovely. So if you see our full reviews of each of those titles, allaboutsymbian.com, of course. We've just got time for a bit of general discussion. Now, I sent across the HTC HD7, which is a Windows Phone 7 device, to David Gilson to try. And most of us have tried these devices over the last few months. And occasionally we come back and comment on our take on where Microsoft have got to in terms of the OS and where Nokia might be heading with it in terms of appropriating the functionality of the OS in a few months' time, of course. So everything kind of gearing up very, very slowly towards the end of the year and a Nokia Windows Phone device, probably Windows Phone 7.5 or Windows Phone 8 by then. So David, what are your impressions so far? Did the HD7 get the Nodo update, and how slick is it looking?
Right, well, it's looking very slick. Scrolling of built-in operating system menus is very silky smooth. The Nodo update makes it very easy to copy and paste text. It was actually baffling me for a while because it's actually easier to do than, say, in Android, where you have to do a long press. You don't. You just press and you get the little start and end selectors. So that's very good. It does have a long way to go in utility. For example, there's no way to organize applications. It seems to be very, very slow when it's updating things like social networks. So no matter which application I've tried, it's been slow to update. And also third-party applications does have very, very jerky scrolling, although I've read around the blogosphere that will be fixed in future firmware updates. And, of course, the lack of multitasking is so annoying. Just say if you need to pop into another application to look up a password or just something for reference, and then you go back to where you were and you've completely lost what you were doing. So that is really annoying. And I'm not the People Hub. I'm not too impressed with that at the moment, but I was impressed at how well it actually integrated all of my contacts with minimal input from me. That was good. I'll give it that. Although at the moment, it just doesn't quite have, Windows Phone 7 just doesn't have the utility that I want from a smartphone platform.
It's interesting listening to David list all of those points. So far, what we've heard about the sort of the next update to Windows Phone, which is being referred to as Mango or Windows 7.5, depending on who you ask. I think Microsoft have just referred to it as the next version. All of those points are actually being addressed to some extent or another, and of course that will be the version that runs on the first Nokia devices. But we are expecting to hear more from Microsoft next week about what sort of additional features are being added in the next version, and I'll be at an event in London and I'll report back from that maybe in next week's podcast about some of the additional features that are coming. So I think it's interesting. It's quite difficult to judge some of these devices at the moment because, as we've said before, hardware makes up a large dimension of it. And so you kind of have to block that off in your mind until you actually see the first device. But of course, it's also the software. And I think actually some pretty small changes, which we know are coming, could make a very big difference to the overall user experience of the device. And so in all this assessment, just bear in mind that when we're talking about this, it is going to look significantly different by the time we get round to the first Nokia Windows Phone device. And on that subject, Nokia is still saying they hope to do it in 2011, but I think quite sensibly this time round aren't actually making any concrete commitments.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that I can't believe I'm going to be the big Microsoft defender. David, you're not a big user of Facebook, are you?
I check in once or twice a day.
So, okay, so, I mean, the People Hub at the moment is very much focused on Facebook and Windows Live integration. Twitter is coming up in the Mango update as well. So at the moment, basically, from my reading, the Windows Phone is basically integrating to social network where you don't really have a social network. And I think that's a big, that is one of those issues that that will make Windows Phone seem a little bit less. Certainly for me, you know, half of my life, you know, sort of, I hate to say it, but the Eurovision people and all of that stuff, they're kind of on Facebook. Twitter's more the tech people and everything. So for me, it's, you know, it's actually quite a good integration. And the fact that it pulled everybody in, organized everything, got the thumbnails and addresses and everything, it was a lovely sync. And it remains in sync. Again, Windows Phone is a phone that is assuming from its core design, it will always be connected and it will always be cloud. Essentially, Windows Phone, don't forget, is a cloud viewer as well as a mobile phone that makes calls. It doesn't store a huge amount locally. And also, in terms of, I'm just going to pick you up on there, you couldn't organize applications. You can. What happens is you have the alphabetical list on the right-hand side of the screen in the same way that Android has an alphabetized list of applications and the Palm home screen way back in the day was an alphabetized list of applications. And you can take your favorite ones onto the Windows Live tiles on the left-hand side of the home screen, the ones that you can slide between. So you can take your favorite applications and put them on the main funky home screen, which you can do with Android, with iOS, with all of those. And then you leave all your applications on the other side. The paradigm of here's all your applications, here's your favorite blocks here, it looks slightly different, but it is there. So you can organize your favorite applications, I would say.
Well, I disagree with that because I'd say compared to Symbian and Android, it is actually functionally deficient because you basically have a main list and a favorites list.
Yes, okay, it's an interesting point of order, but I still think that, you know, putting them up on your home screen is your organization. Yes, we will no doubt see photo and everything, but the point that you have here, and it's through the entire system, is that you have a long list and then you have favorites. The People Hub is a long list. You can have your favorites. You can, you know, you pull them out. Your music is a long list. You can star and heart your favorites. You know, part of the DNA of the system is to have that consistent feel of interface going all the way through it. And Microsoft, in the Metro design, have decided this is how we're going to do it. You have a list, and then you have favorites. You don't have the subcategories and subcategories and subcategories that you go on. And, you know, for a whole number of smartphones, that was the way it was done from about 93, I think. I think we were shouting at Palm to have this organization.
Yeah. The whole thing about the user interfaces and the way you organize applications, it depends entirely, really, whether you're a norm mob just starting out with a few applications and a few favorites, or whether you're an absolute ultra geek who wants subfolders and 15 home screens full of widgets. And there's such a spectrum in between.
We call them Linux users, Steve.
you mean the enlightened few, Ewan?
It's okay, the rapture's on Saturday. You're still here.
And there literally is no way any one manufacturer, any one operating system can really cater for all types of users all in one go. There is no one-size-fits-all. And each of the different flavors, whether it's Windows Phone or Symbian or Android or iOS, they all have a subtly different flavors and people either feel at home or they don't feel at home. And I think we can't really criticize any one UI too much at this point. We're running right out of time, guys. We must finish the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Dan in Sussex from?
Rafe Blanford.
And thank you up in Hull.
Hey, it's David Gilson. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
And thanks to you and Spence up in Edinburgh.
Hello. Bye-bye. I'm off to New York now.
Will you be here for next week's podcast?
I don't know. When's next week's podcast going to be?
Friday.
I could call it in.
Or Monday, maybe. We'll see.
We'll see. Anyway, you may or may not catch the Scotsman on next week's Insight podcast from allaboutsymbian.com. Until then, thank you very much for listening.